welcome to a half hour of Mind Webs. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This is Michael Hansen. The Mindweb story this time is by William Sansom. The Vertical Ladder, copyright 1960, from The Stories of William Sansom. As he felt the first watery eggs of sweat moistening the palms of his hands, as with every rung higher his body seemed to weigh more heavily, this young man, Flegg, regretted in sudden desperation, but still in vain, the irresponsible events that had thrust him up into his present precarious climb. Here he was, isolated on a vertical iron ladder, flat to the side of a gasometer, a huge storage tank, and bound to climb higher and higher until he should reach the vertiginous skyward summit. How could he ever have wished this on himself? How easy it had been to laugh away his cautionary fears on the firm ground. Now he would give the very hands that clung to the ladder for a safe conduct to solid earth. It had been a strong spring day, abruptly as warm as midsummer. The sun flooded the park, streets with sudden heat, and Flegg and his friends had felt stifled in their thick winter clothes. The green glare of the new leaves everywhere struck the eye too fiercely, and the air seemed almost sticky from the exhalations of buds and swelling resins. They had wandered out from the park by a back gate into an area of back streets. The houses there were small and old, some of them already falling into disrepair. Short streets, cobbles, narrow pavements, and the only shops, a tobacconist or a desolate corner oil shop to color the gray. It was the outcrop of some industrial undertaking beyond. At first, these quiet, almost deserted streets had seemed more restful than the park. But soon a dusty air of peeling plaster and powdering brick, the dark windows and the dry stone steps, the very dryness altogether had proved more wearying than before. So that when suddenly the houses ended and the ground opened to reveal the yards of a disused gasworks, Flegg and his friends had welcomed the green of nettles and milkwort that grew among the scrap iron and broken brick. They walked out into the wasteland, the two girls and Flegg and the other two boys, and stood presently before the old gasometer itself. Among the ruined sheds, this was the only erection still whole. It still predominated over the yards, towering high above other buildings for hundreds of feet around. So they threw bricks against its rusted sides. The rust flew off in flakes, and the iron rang dully. Flegg, who wished to excel in the eyes of the dark-haired girl, began throwing his bricks higher than the others. He felt the girl's eyes follow his shoulders, and his shoulders broadened.
Bet you can't climb as high as you can throw.
Flegg turned around scoffing, so that the girl had quickly shouted again, laughing shrilly and pointing upward.
Climb to the top of the gasworks, then. Go on, climb it. Here, tie my hanky on the top. Tie my flag to the top.
Even then, Flegg had a second chance. It occurred to him instantly that he could laugh it off. But a hysterical emphasis now possessed the girl's face. She was dancing up and down and clapping her hands insistently, and this confused Flegg. So, off we go then, he had said, and he had turned to the gasometer. It was not, after all, so very high. It was hardly a full-sized gasometer. Its trellised iron top rail would have stood level with the roof coping of a 5- or 6-story tenement. Until then, Flegg had only seen the gasometer as a rough mass of iron. But now, every detail sprang into abrupt definition. He studied it intently, alertly considering its size and every feature of stability. The brown, rusted iron sheeting smeared here and there with red lead, a curious buckling that sometimes deflated its curved bulk as though a vacuum were collapsing it from within. The ladders scaling the sides flush with the sheeting. the grid of girders, a complexity of struts, the bolting. There were two ladders, one a Jacob's ladder clamped fast to the side, another that was more of a staircase, zigzagging up the belly of the gasometer in easy gradients and provided with a safety rail. This must have been erected later as a substitute for the Jacob's ladder, which demanded an unnecessarily stringent climb and was now unused, for some 20 feet of its longer rungs had been worn away. However, there was apparently some painting in progress, for a painter's wooden ladder had been propped beneath, reaching to the undamaged bottom of the vertical ladder. The ascent was thus serviceable again. Flagg looked quickly at the foot of the wooden ladder. Was it well grounded? And then at the head, farther up, was this secure? And then up to the top, screwing his eyes to note any fault in the iron rungs, reaching innumerably, indistinctly, and dizzyingly to the summit platform. The two boys and his own girl kept up a chorus of encouraging abuse. But the second girl had remained quiet throughout. She was already frightened, sensing instantly that the guilt for some tragedy was hers alone, although she had never, in fact, opened her mouth. Suddenly, the chorus rose shriller. Behind him, they still kept up a din, still kept him up to pitch, worrying at him viciously. So Flagg realized finally that there was no alternative. He had to climb the gasometer by the vertical ladder. And as soon as this was finally settled, the doubt cleared from his mind. He braced his shoulders and suddenly found himself really making light of the job. After all, he thought, it isn't so high. Why should I worry? Hundreds of men climb such ladders every day. No one falls. The ladders are clamped as safe as houses. He began to smile within himself at his earlier perturbations. Added to this, the girl now ran up to him and handed him her handkerchief. As her black eyes frowned a smile at him, he saw that her expression no longer held its vicious, laughing scorn, but now instead had grown softer, with a look of real encouragement and even admiration.
Here's your flag. Tell you what, you don't really have to go. I'll believe you.
But this came too late. Flagg had accepted the climb. It was fact. And already he felt something of an exhilarating glow of glory. He took the handkerchief, blew the girl a dramatic kiss, and started up the lowest rungs of the ladder at a run. This painter's ladder was placed at a comfortable slant, but nevertheless Flagg had only climbed some 10 feet, what might have corresponded to the top of a first-floor window, when he began to slow up. He stopped running and gripped harder at the rungs above and placed his feet more firmly on the unseen bars below. Although he had not yet measured his distance from the ground, somehow he sensed he was already unnaturally high, with nothing but air and a precarious skeleton of wooden bars between him and the receding ground. He felt independent of solid support, yet, according to his eyes, which stared straight forward at the iron sheeting beyond, he might have been standing on the lowest rungs by the ground. The sensation of height infected him strongly. It had become an urgent necessity to maintain a balance. Each muscle of his body became unnaturally alert. This was not an unpleasant feeling. He almost enjoyed a new athletic command of every precarious movement. He climbed methodically until he reached the ladder head and the first of the perpendicular iron rungs. Here, for a moment, Flagg had paused. He had rested his knees up against the last 3 steps of the safely slanting wooden ladder. He had grasped the 2 side supports of the rusted iron that led so straightly upward. His knees then clung to the motherly wood. His hands felt the iron cold and gritty. The rust powdered off and smeared him with its red dust. One large scrap flaked off and fell on his face as he looked upward. He wanted to brush this away from his eyes, but the impulse was, to his surprise, much less powerful than the vice-like will that clutched his hands to the iron support. His hands remained firmly gripping the iron. He had to shake off the rust flake with a jerk of his head. Even then, this sharp movement nearly unbalanced him, and his stomach gulped coldly with sudden shock. He settled his knees more firmly against the wood, though he forced himself to laugh at his sudden feat, so that in some measure his poise did really return. Nevertheless, he did not alter the awkward, knock-kneed position of his legs, clinging for safety. With all this, he had scarcely paused. Now, he pulled at the stanchions of the iron ladder. They were as firm as if they had been driven into rock. He looked up, following the dizzying rise of the rungs to the skyline. From this angle, flat against the iron sheeting, the gasometer appeared higher than before. The blue sky seemed to descend and almost touch it. The redness of the rust dissolved into a deepening gray shadow. The distant curved summit loomed over black and high. Although it was immensely stable, as seen in rounded perspective from a few yards away, there against the side it appeared top-heavy, so that this huge segment of sheet iron seemed to have lost the support of its invisible complement behind, a support that was now unseen and therefore unfelt. And Flaig imagined, despite himself, that the entire erection had become unsteady, that quite possibly the gasometer might suddenly blow over like a gigantic top-heavy sail. He lowered his eyes quickly and concentrated on the hands before him. He began to climb. He looked down. His friends appeared shockingly small. Their bodies had disappeared, and he saw only their upturned faces. He wanted to wave to demonstrate in some way a carefree attitude, but then instantly he felt frustrated as his hands refused to unlock their grip. He turned to the rungs again with a smile dying on his lips. He swallowed uneasily and continued to tread slowly upward, hand after hand, foot after foot. He'd climbed 10 rungs of the iron ladder when his hands first began to feel moist, when suddenly, as though a catastrophe had overtaken him, not gradually but in one overpowering second, he realized that he was afraid, incontrovertibly. He could cover it no longer. He admitted it all over his body. His hands gripped with pitiable eagerness. They were now alert to a point of shivering, as though the nerves inside them had been forced taut for so long that now they had burst beyond their strained tegument. His feet no longer trod firmly on the rungs beneath, but first stepped for their place timorously, and then glued themselves to the iron. In this way, his body lost most of its poise. These nerves and muscles in his 2 legs and 2 arms seemed to work independently, no longer integrated with the rhythm of his body, but moving with the dangerous, unwilled jerk of crippled limbs. His body hung slack away from the ladder, with nothing beneath it but a 30-foot drop to the ground. Only his hands and feet were fed with the security of an attachment. Most of him lay off the ladder, hanging in space. His arms revolted at the strain of their familiar angle, as though they were flies' feet denying all natural laws. For the first time, as the fear took hold of him, he felt that what he had attempted was impossible. He could never achieve the top. If at this height of only 30 feet, as if it were 3 stories of a building, he felt afraid, what would he feel at 60 feet? Yet he trod heavily up. He was afraid, but not desperate. He dreaded each stop, yet forced himself to believe that at some time it would be over. It could not take long. A memory crossed his mind. It occurred to him vividly, then flashed away, for his eyes and mind were continually concentrated on the rusted iron bars and the white knuckles of his hands. But for an instant, he remembered waking up long ago in the nursery and seeing that the windows were light, as if they reflected a coldness of moonlight. Only they were not so much lit by light as by a sensation of space. He had crawled out of bed and climbed onto a chair that stood beneath the window. It was as he had thought. Outside, there was space, nothing else, a limited area of space. Yet this was not unnatural, for soon his logical eyes had supplied for what had at first appeared an impossible infinity. The later image of a perfectly reasonable flood. A vast plain of still water, as far as his eyes could see. It lapped silently at the sides of the house, and in the light of an unseen moon, winked and washed darkly, concealing great beasts of mystery beneath its black, calm surface. This water attracted him. He wished to jump into it from the window and immerse himself in it and allow his head to sink slowly under. However, he was perched up too high. He felt, alone at the window, infinitely high, so that the flood seemed to lie in miniature at a great distance below. As later in life, when he was ill, he had seen the objects of his bedroom grow small and infinitely remote in the fevered reflection behind his eyes. Isolated at the little window, he had been frightened by the emptiness surrounding him. Only the sky and the water and the marooned stone wall of the house. He had been terrified, yet drawn down by dread and desire. Then a battleship had sailed by. He had wakened up, saved by the appearance of the battleship. And now, on the ladder, he had a sudden hope that something as large and stable would intervene again to help him. But 10 rungs farther up, he began to sweat more violently than ever. Another flake of rust fell on his forehead. This time it stuck in the wetness. He felt physically exhausted. Fear was draining his strength and the precarious position of his body. Each stressed muscle ached. His body weighed more heavily at each step upward. It sagged beneath his arms like a leaden sack. His legs no longer provided their adequate support. It seemed as though they needed every pull of their muscles to force themselves, his independent limbs, close to the ladder. The wind blew faster. It dragged now at his coat. It blew its space about him. It echoed silently, a lonesome spaciousness.
Don't look down.
The blood whispered in his temples. 3 quarters up the gasometer, and 50 feet from the ground, Flegg grew desperate. Every other consideration suddenly left him. He wanted only to reach ground as quickly as possible. Only that. Nothing else mattered. He stopped climbing and clung to the ladder, panting. Very slowly, lowering his eyes carefully, so that he could raise them instantly if he saw too much, he looked down a rung, and another past his armpit, past his waist, and focused them on the ground beneath. He looked quickly up again. He pressed himself to the ladder. Tears started in his eyes. For a moment they reeled red with giddiness. He closed them, shutting out everything. Then instantly he opened them, afraid that something might happen. He must watch his hands, watch the bars, watch the rusted iron sheeting itself. No movement should escape him. The struts might come creaking loose. The whole edifice might sway over. Although a fading reason told him that the gasometer had remained firm for years and was still as steady as a cliff, his horrified senses suspected that this was the one moment in the building's life when a wind would blow that was too strong for it and some defective strut would snap and the whole edifice would heel over and crash to the ground. This image became so clear he could see the sheets of iron buckling and folding like cloth as the huge weight sank to the earth. The ground had receded horribly. The drop now appeared terrifying, out of all proportion to this height he had reached. From the ground, such a height would have appeared unnoteworthy. But now, from here, the distance seemed to have doubled. Each object familiar to his everyday eyes, his friends, the lampposts, the brick wall, the curb, a drain, all these had grown infinitely small. His senses demanded that these objects should be of a certain accustomed size. Alternately, the world of chimneys and attic windows and roof coping would grow unpleasantly giant as his pavement-bred eyes approached. Even now, the iron sheeting that stretched to either side and above and below seemed to have grown. He was lost among such huge, smooth dimensions, grown smaller himself and clinging now like a child, lost on some monstrous desert of red dust. These unfamiliarities shocked his nerves more than the danger of falling. The sense of isolation was overpowering. All things were suddenly alien. Yet exposed on the iron spaces with the unending winds blowing around him among such free things, he felt shut in. Trembling and panting so that he stifled himself with the shortness of his own breath, he took the first step downward. A commotion began below. A confusion of cries came drifting up to him. Above all, he could hear the single voice of the girl who had so far kept quiet. Flegg, thinking that these cries were to warn him of some new danger apparent only from the ground, he gripped himself into the ladder and looked down again. He glanced down for a fractional second, but in that time saw enough. He saw that the girl was screaming and pointing to the base of the iron ladder. He saw the others crowding around her, gesticulating. He saw that she really had been crying, "Put it back," and he realized now what the words meant. Someone had removed the painter's ladder. It lay clearly on the ground, outlined white like a child's drawing of a ladder. The boys must have seen his first step downward, and then, from fun or from spite, they had removed his only means of retreat. He remembered that from the base of the ladder to the ground, the drop fell 20 feet. He considered quickly descending and appealing from the bottom of the ladder, but he foresaw that for precious minutes they would jeer and argue, refusing to replace the ladder, and he felt then that he could never risk these minutes, unnerved, with his strength failing. Besides, he had already noticed that the whole group of them were wandering off. The boys were driving the quiet girl away, now more concerned with her than with Flegg. The quiet girl's sense of guilt had been brought to a head by the removal of the ladder. Now she was hysterically terrified. She was yelling to them to put the ladder back. She, only she, the passive one, sensed the terror that awaited them all. But her screams defeated their own purpose. They had altogether distracted the attention of the others. Now it was fun to provoke more screams, to encourage this new distraction, and they forgot about Flegg far up and beyond them. They were wandering away. They were abandoning him, casually unconcerned that he was alone and helpless up in his wide prison of rust. They were wandering away. There was no retreat. They did not even know he was in difficulty. So Flegg had no option but to climb higher. Desperately, he tried to shake off his fear. He actually shook his head. Then he stared hard at the rungs immediately facing his eyes and tried to imagine that he was not high up at all. He lifted himself tentatively by one rung and by another, and in this way dragged himself higher and higher until he must have been some 10 rungs from the top, over the 5th story of a house, with now perhaps only 1 more story to climb. He imagined that he might then be approaching the summit platform, and to measure this last distance, he looked up. He looked up, and he felt for the first time panicked beyond desperation. He almost let go. His senses screamed to let go. Yet his hands refused to open. The nerves left his hands so that they might have been dried bones of fingers gripped around the rungs. He shivered, grew giddy, and flung himself frog-like onto the ladder. The sight of the top of the gasometer had proved endemically more frightful than the appearance of the drop beneath. There lay about it a sense of material danger, not of the risk of falling, but of something removed and unhuman, a sense of appalling isolation. It echoed its elemental iron aloofness. A wind blew round it that had never known the warmth of flesh nor the softness of green fibers. Its blind eyes were raised above the world. It was like the eyeless iron visor of an ancient god. It touched against the sky, having risen an awful perpendicular to this isolation, solitary as the gray granite cliffs that marked the end of the northern world. It was immeasurably old, outside the connotation of time. It was nothing human, only washed by the high weather, echoing with wind, visited never alone. And in this summit, Flagg measured clearly the full distance of his climb. This close skyline emphasized the whirling space beneath him. He clearly saw a man fall through this space, spread-eagling to smash with the sickening force of a locomotive on the stone beneath. The man turned slowly in the air, yet his thoughts raced faster than he fell. Flagg, clutching his body close to the rust, made small weeping sounds through his mouth. Shivering, shuddering, he began to tread up again, working his knees and elbows outward like a frog, so that with a hot roaring, he hurried himself. He began to scramble up, wrenching at his last strength, whispering urgent, meaningless words to himself like the swift whispers that close in on a nightmare. A huge weight pulled at him, dragging him to drop. He climbed higher. He reached the top rung and found his face staring still at a wall of red dust. He looked wild with terror. It was the top rung. The ladder had ended, yet no platform. The real top rungs were missing. The platform jutted 5 impassable feet above. Flagg stared dumbly, encircling his head like a lost animal. Then he jammed his legs in the lower rungs and his arms to the armpits in through the top rungs. And there he hung, shivering, past knowing what more he could ever do. You've heard The Vertical Ladder from The Stories of William Sansom, copyright 1960. I'm Michael Hansen, technical production for this program by Rich Grody. Mindwebs is produced at WHA Radio.